The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. The president's going to Poland. Retired Admiral James Stavridis provides color.
I think it's a good move for the president to go there. I think this visit makes a lot of sense.
Meanwhile, Mr. Trump's back and forth on China trade causes markets to wobble. But China is no pushover.
If the president's goal is to make the Chinese cry uncle, I think he's going to make it harder for himself to emerge with a deal.
Obamagate has not gone away yet and could linger for years. Greg Jarrett gives an update on new legal developments.
I expect the feds to bring charges based on the same standards that were employed by another DOJ employee called Robert Mueller.
And remember the famous neurosurgeon Ben Carson? Good things are happening under his leadership at HUD.
You know, a lot of people in our country have made a tremendous amount of money, and they're going to invest that money somewhere. You know, we're going to do things that take into consideration the men and women who have been forgotten about.
I am Hugh Hewitt. Catch my program each weekday morning live 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com, and let me invite you to join us now by video. And take a moment to follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. The president is fresh back from France and the G7 conference, where he got no shortage of updates on the changing attitudes toward China trade and Iran. Now he's headed for Poland. Why Poland? That's a question I asked retired Admiral James Stavridis, who makes it his business to help us understand geopolitics in our fast-changing world. We spoke Wednesday on the Hugh Hewitt Show. President's going to Poland this week. You think that's important. Why?
Poland is a big, important anchor country in Europe, Hugh. Think of them as sort of the main rampart to the east and a buttress against Russia. Historically been poised kind of between Western Europe and Russia. It's been a battleground many times, as you know. I think it's a good move for the president to go there on Sunday. It's the 80th anniversary of the commencement of the Second World War in 1939. So this is an important historical moment, and keeping Poland integrated with U.S. defense. We've got about 5,000 troops there. I think this visit makes a lot of sense.
Has his record on NATO been good, bad, or indifferent? Gotten them to move towards the 2% goal they have promised to reach of defense spending as a percentage of GDP?
I think you've summarized it well. The atmospherics at times have been strained, let's be honest. Part of that has been he's taken an extremely aggressive approach. Now, I worked both for President Bush, the second, if you will, and for President Barack Obama. Both of them also pushed very hard on NATO. Neither of them, truth be told, got the results that President Trump has gotten by taking an extremely forceful personal kind of lean in on the get up to 2% of GDP. I think where the strain has been with NATO has been on U.S. A sense that the U.S. will not step up and take on continued operational leadership roles the way we have in the past. There's frustration with the Europeans on that score. That's created tension in the alliance.
Now, Admiral, I'm leery of the withdrawal plan the president is touting on Afghanistan and of the peace with the Afghans. What is the role of NATO in Afghanistan? If the president decides to pull the U.S. troops out, is it a de facto withdrawal of NATO as well?
I think it will be. It feels very unlikely to me that the alliance would want to remain there after a U.S. withdrawal. Let's back up. This has always been a NATO mission. When I commanded it, it had 150,000 troops there. We're now down to about 15,000 U.S. troops and about 7,000 NATO troops. The right answer here, my view, is not a complete withdrawal, but we could afford further downsizing and then see if the Taliban live up to the promises of a ceasefire, working with the Afghan government.
And we cut and ran in Iraq, and it's ISIS filled its vacuum. When we cut and run, bad things happen. We're getting very close to a hard Brexit. Let's just assume for a moment that it is a hard Brexit. There is no deal, and none is forthcoming quickly after a hard Brexit. Tell us how NATO operates, and tell us whether or not a hard Brexit would, in fact, impact that.
Luckily, it will not. And I've often said, and I believe this, that in the event of a hard Brexit, which I believe would be a mistake for Great Britain and a mistake for the rest of Europe to allow that to occur, if a hard Brexit happens, NATO is essentially unaffected by that. The treaty that establishes NATO has nothing to do with the European Union. The UK will continue to operate.
Those who follow the markets are growing weary of the continuing uncertainty about trading future with China. Trade relationships are complex, and constructive reset of our status with China may be good for all of us. But some conservatives are concerned how all of this is affecting the president's chances at a second term. My colleagues Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson from AM 560 The Answer in Chicago got an update from David Drucker of The Washington Examiner.
On the issue of China and a trade deal, is there a real political cost that Trump is in danger of paying if a deal with China doesn't get done?
Well, I think the danger of a trade dispute with China getting out of control and contributing to a downturn in the economy is a very serious threat for Trump. I think it would be serious for any president, but particularly for him because his approval numbers are always middling, and the only area where he gets positive job marks that exceed his overall job approval is on the economy. And so I think for him in particular, it would be problematic. Now, I've always said that confronting China on trade and defense matters and a whole host of issues, I think there's a lot of sympathy across the political spectrum for confronting China. I think the issue is how you go about it. I think the assumption that China's going to fold, that the jobs issue for them and the economic issue for them is so paramount that they can't afford to go toe-to-toe with us, I think it's a little bit misguided because China has grander designs than simply building and growing an economy. And obviously they have, you know, issues about keeping everybody happy. Number one, they don't have elections. Number two, they want to supplant the United States as the world's preeminent superpower. They don't just want to kick us out of the Pacific, which is one of their sub-goals. They want to get rid of the U.S.-led liberal world order. So if the president's goal is to make the Chinese cry uncle, I think he's going to make it harder for himself to emerge from this dispute with a deal. And so I just think that this is going to be very difficult. I'm not saying he shouldn't do it. I'm not saying it's not doable. I do think it would be easier if he didn't insist on fighting multiple trade disputes at once and they all went into this together.
How do you think civil unrest in Hong Kong is going to affect any of the talks with China?
Well, it's unclear because the president doesn't seem to prioritize these sort of democratic human rights issues the way most presidents have, at least rhetorically. You know, most presidents, Democrat or Republican, would at least pay lip service to the idea that we expect our trading partners, people we do business with, to treat their citizens and territories with some modicum of human rights concern and employ some sort of democratic value in how they do that. The president, it's just never been high on his agenda. So he could use it as a leverage point with the Chinese, which would be good for Hong Kong and good for the United States, but it may not be something he cares about. And, you know, he kind of goes back and forth, right? I mean, he refers to autocratic leaders as nice people who are great leaders.
Over the past 18 months, our country has been shaken by these mass shootings that have broken hearts and heightened tension. The El Paso and Dayton attacks that left 31 people dead left many feeling helpless and hopeless. Although many Democratic candidates tried to score political points on it, some politicos are making earnest attempts to try and make this stop. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey has busied himself working on a stop order solution. I spoke with Governor Ducey, who I call America's best governor, recently about his progress. I wanted to talk to you ever since the tragedies in El Paso and Dayton, because I think stop orders ought to be on the agenda of every state legislature that doesn't already have some version of them. Would you explain to the public what a stop order is?
A stop order is a tool. It's a severe threat order of protection. It's when you have a person in your midst, like Nicholas Cruz, like the person that did the Parkland shooting, that everyone knows is a danger to the community. Let's remember, Nicholas Cruz posted on YouTube that he wanted to be known as a school shooter. Yet when everything broke bad in Parkland, the authorities said there was nothing that they could do. A stop order would have allowed them to prevent and avoid that mass killing. So what this is something that respects Second Amendment rights. It has due process, but it allows law enforcement or leaders in the community to make an identification and action to happen before a tragedy.
Now, Governor, do you think it will get through the legislature this time?
I believe we need to have more action to protect our citizens. So, yes, we're going to do more in Arizona. I thought this was a good idea after Parkland. I think it's a good idea today. I think all leaders need to present ideas that can keep their community safer. And you can do this and respect Second Amendment rights. That's how you have to do it.
Now, I've heard from gun owners who are concerned that someone upset with them for reasons unrelated to mental stability or danger will call in and say, you know, like radio blogger has a gun at his house and I think he's going to shoot up the neighborhood shopping mall.
Which he's not, by the way.
Which he's not going to do. But let's just say that's the kind of call. What protections does the stop order legislation have in it against vindictive calls to disarm someone?
So our stop order has felony consequences against someone who has a vindictive claim or a false claim. So in that type of setting, there's those types of consequences that would prevent that from happening and keep that from happening. You know, without any stop order, we have some of that right now when you have bad relational situations. So what we have in the Arizona Safe School Plan and this specific stop order, which is up on our website, azgovernor.gov, is, I think, something that other states can take. They can look at it. They can modify it. We think this is a good plan. It's been thoroughly vetted. As you said, it's been endorsed by the NRA. It has components from Gabby Giffords' plan. So it's to bring a broad coalition together. And Hugh, it's only to bring one more tool that we can do to prevent and avoid these tragedies that we see happening all over the country. There's no one law, rule, or regulation that's going to do this. Obviously, we've got a cultural crisis of the heart and the soul happening across so much of our society. But I do think we also should act with good ideas in public policy and do everything that we can.
For my complete interviews with Admiral Stavridis and Governor Ducey, go to townhallreview.com. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
I expect the feds to bring charges based on the same standards that were employed by another DOJ employee called Robert Mueller.
Criminal accountability? The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. None of us should be embarrassed if we're confused by the tangle of malfeasance loosely referred to as Obamagate. Names like McCabe, Page, Stroke, and Comey are often connected with Obamagate. But why is it named for our former president? There's evidence that the Obama administration was pulling strings back to 2016 in an attempt to sabotage or undermine the Trump campaign and then sink his presidency. My Salem colleague Jennifer Horn, sitting in for Sebastian Gorka, spoke with Greg Jarrett of Fox News. Jarrett's forthcoming book is titled Witch Hunt.
This is, or could be, one of the biggest political scandals of our time. What do you know about these charges coming against Andrew McCabe? Is that going to be a reality?
Well, I hope it is. It should be. Look, Andrew McCabe has helped put people behind bars for lying.
Sure.
He should be held to the same legal standard. And all of this emanates from a scathing condemnation of McCabe by the Inspector General at the Department of Justice, who, by the way, is a neutral investigator,
mm-hmm.
who concluded that he lacked candor. That's a polite way of saying he lied on not one but four occasions. When questioned by federal agents about leaking information to the media, I expect the feds to bring charges based on the same standards that were employed by another DOJ employee called Robert Mueller, special counsel, who leveled criminal charges for lying against numerous people associated with Donald Trump, including Michael Flynn, George Papadopoulos, Roger Stone. So there should be equal treatment of the law.
There are a lot of people who are losing faith in the FBI and the Department of Justice, not necessarily in the rank and file members, but the Department of Justice at the highest levels under the Obama administration. You said something that kind of struck me. You said Michael Horowitz is an independent investigator. And, you know, it's sad that we have to point this out, because if you're being investigated by the FBI, I sure as heck want them all to be independent. But that has not been the case so far.
Yes, you're right. And it's people like James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, who, you know, at the top levels of the FBI abuse their positions of power for political reasons. But they took first the Hillary Clinton email case, in which she clearly committed crimes, and they exonerated her for what can only be described as political reasons. And then they doubled down by launching an investigation against Donald Trump in a sort of secret counterintelligence probe that I'm sure had the approval of the Obama White House.
How far up did this go?
Oh, it went all the way to the White House. And we know this for two reasons. First of all, it was a criminal investigation disguised as a counterintelligence probe. Now, a counterintelligence investigation, by its very nature, is for the benefit of the existing president. You gather intelligence information and you provide it to the president of the United States. So that was being provided to Barack Obama. And we also know, because there was a text message exchange in late summer 2016, right after the FBI counterintelligence probe was launched, in which it said the White House wants to know everything we're doing. This was a text between, you know, Lisa Page and Peter Strzok. So that certainly meant that Obama was informed of it, approved of it. Mm-hmm. He was being advised of it, probably on an almost daily basis by John Brennan, the CIA director who was debriefing him.
Ben Carson, a prominent neurosurgeon turned presidential candidate in 2016, has not been getting much news coverage since then. But he's been busy in his role as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, one of the original members of the President Trump cabinet. Recently, Dr. Carson shared his progress at HUD with Mike Lindell, who was sitting in for Sebastian Gorka.
It's been spectacular what's been going on. You frequently don't hear about it in the news because it's good news. With the Opportunity Zones, we've got tens of billions of dollars pouring in, and I've already had an opportunity to visit several of the sites. One of the very first ones was in Vicksburg, Mississippi, a sawmill that was closing down. And because of the Opportunity Zones, it was able to be revitalized, people rehired, and as a result of that, workforce housing is being built. And it's just having, you know, a blossoming effect on the whole area. I was in Salt Lake City recently, and a multifamily complex was being built with an emphasis on autism and how to get people with autism into the workforce and independent. And, you know, a lot of people in our country have made a tremendous amount of money, and they're going to invest that money somewhere.
Right.
Well, this program gives them an incentive to invest that money in the areas that are traditionally neglected and that would have continued to be neglected. And that's what the president meant when he said, you know, we're going to do things that take into consideration the men and women who have been forgotten about. Then a couple of weeks ago, I was in Spokane, Washington, to visit one of the Envision centers that had been opened. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, you know, there was some controversy because one of the liberal groups offered the center $100,000 if they would take the name Envision Center off of it, because it was actually doing very well. It was doing exactly what we designed them to do, and that's to bring in all the multiple services under one roof.
Right.
And we can take people wherever they are. People who are illiterate, we have programs to teach them how to read, and then we have ways to get people employment and child care and all these kinds of things under one roof. And, you know, that was the whole concept. But, you know, we've become so polarized that there are people saying it's working, and we don't want to make, we want to make sure that the administration doesn't get any credit for it.
You know, Secretary, it's like, you know, I've seen, you know, back, you know, I'm doing stuff in Detroit. This was a couple years ago, and I seen a couple downtown Detroit, and they were like the hope of the neighborhood. They would give the shirt off their back, and there was this nice Christian couple, and right in the worst part of Detroit, but they were like protected. Well, I put a roof on my foundation. We put a roof on her. We built her a bigger building. And now I was back there last year. It's expanded out from there. You start putting in these opportunity zones, and that's the hope of the neighborhood. And it just goes out from there. And
exactly.
I was in Detroit too, and there was one of the things I couldn't believe. There was a church there. They had moved out of there. There wasn't no active services. This huge, 100-year-old amazing church. And for 1 year, it was over 1 year. No one had been there as in services. Not one broken window. And this was in some of the worst parts of Detroit because that was their hope, you know. And you know what you're doing and what the administration's doing with these opportunity zones, you know, what a great opportunity.
One of the coolest things was in St. Louis, an old abandoned foundry was the central focus. They were building all around that, grocery stores and entertainment, workforce housing, all kinds of things. And the best thing is when I went to visit, you know, the governor was a Republican, the mayor was a Democrat, the congressman was a Democrat, and everybody was having a love fest.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Whatever sex you identify with, and it has very quickly ended up destroying a lot of girls' dreams, including college scholarships, disheartening because it's completely unfair.
Women's athletics are under duress at the state of Connecticut. Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. It wasn't long ago that women's athletics in high school and college were surging. Thanks to Title IX, which became law under Richard Nixon in 1972, the challenges and satisfaction of competitive sports have become a reality for millions of female students. But in at least 17 states, that progress is getting threatened by athletes identifying for purposes of sport as a sex different from their birth sex. But some brave young female athletes are pushing back, and the state of Connecticut will likely have to defend its position in the courts. My colleague, syndicated host Larry Elder, spoke recently about this fight with Denise Harley, legal counsel at Alliance Defending Freedom.
Connecticut is one of 17 states that allows transgender high school athletes to compete without any restrictions. As a result, transgender male athletes have been dominating track and field in Connecticut. Not too surprisingly, a lot of the female athletes are not happy about this. I mean, this just seems to me like a no-brainer. These are males. They then compete as transgender, and in the case of Connecticut, no restrictions whatsoever. There isn't even a requirement that they have undergone any kind of process.
That's right. Boys will always have physical advantages over girls, and that's the whole reason we have women's sports. All a boy would have to say is that he believes he identifies as a girl, and
wow.
That's it.
Wow.
And that's what these two boys did.
No series of tests, no interviews, no nothing?
No, that's right. It's how whatever sex you identify with. And it has very quickly ended up destroying a lot of girls' dreams and stealing their opportunities in Connecticut, including taking away the opportunities to compete for college scholarships, to get on the podium. And it's been disheartening because it's completely unfair.
I would assume that there's an outrage in Connecticut. Yes?
Unfortunately, there's not. This is a policy of the statewide Interscholastic Athletic Conference, and even the school administrators, coaches, principals have been supportive of the transgender boys, to the point where eventually my clients, these three very brave female athletes, finally had to file a Title IX complaint and ask the federal government to step in because there was so much resistance and so much defense of these boys coming into the girls' sports and crushing them.
I would imagine, Denise, this is a problem all around the country.
Unfortunately, it is. As you mentioned earlier, there are 17 states that have this sort of nonsensical policy that just flies in the face of biology, and it ends up undermining 50 years of progress that we've made since Title IX was passed. Title IX was the first thing that finally provided equal opportunities for girls and women to compete in athletics, and it did so by creating an equal playing field, by giving them their own division in sports. For example, one of these boys was sort of a middle-of-the-pack runner in winter 2018, spring 2018. He decided he was going to run against the girls, and all of a sudden, he started taking all of the state titles.
Obviously, you haven't given any of these formerly male athletes some sort of psychological examination, but do you believe that some of them are saying that I identify as a female just to win races, not because of a sincere belief that he actually identifies as a female?
We don't have any reason to think that.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do know is that they have obviously showed a very unfair advantage, and it's ended up keeping dozens of girls around the state of Connecticut from being able to earn a medal, to be able to go on to regionals, to be able to be seen by college scouts and recruiters. And whatever the motivation is, it doesn't change the fact that they're biological males and they have much larger muscles, bigger bones, bigger hearts, way more testosterone, and that's why they shouldn't be in the girls' division.
So, Denise Harley, what are you and ADF doing to help them?
Well, we're excited to report that after we filed our Title IX complaint several weeks ago, the federal government Office of Civil Rights has agreed that they are going to investigate this. That means the next step is we're looking forward to a report from the federal government, hopefully with a finding that this policy violates Title IX, violates federal law, and restoring a level playing field. And that should send a message to these other states that they need to correct their policy and stop allowing discrimination against these girls and young women.
And people need to know that the Alliance Defending Freedom provides these fights without charging the client anything. They can only do this without the financial generosity of you guys. So please help. All gifts are tax deductible, can be made by calling 866-435-2252, 866-435-2252, or by visiting yourfreedomfund.org. That's yourfreedomfund.org. Denise Harley, do these, again, male athletes now competing as women, is there any sense that they feel that they do have an unfair advantage? Is there any sense of guilt? Are they as proud of winning their victory as they would if they had competed as a man?
Well, I'll just tell you what they've said on the Today Show and in some other national interviews. And they've said that if the shoe was on the other foot and they were the girls having these boys come in the division, they would be proud of those boys and they would celebrate the transgender boys that were coming in and beating them. So from what we know, they feel like they're being very courageous, and they plan to continue to do so.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
Not only is it a hateful book about the United States, it's also fraudulent history. It's full of lies. I mean, there are lies on every single page.
The debunking of an influential historian when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Howard Zinn published a United States history book circa 1989 titled A People's History of the United States. an author, playwright, and educator, Zinn's history was widely used in public school as well as by individuals around the United States and sold in the millions of copies. Mary Graybar, a resident scholar at the Alexander Hamilton Institute, has recently published Debunking Howard Zinn, following several years of research. Graybar was recently a guest of Dennis Prager.
I just want to tell you two things, and then I want, obviously, you to be the focus of the attention. But you will find this just illuminating. I asked him, do you think the world is better or worse because there is a United States of America in it? And he thought for a moment, and he basically said he's agnostic, that he could not say the world is any better. The implication ultimately was that it was worse. But in direct answer, it was, the world was no better off because the U.S. existed. And then I said, you accuse the U.S. of going into all these wars for imperialist and economic reasons. So what about World War II? And he said he didn't think that was worth fighting either. World War II. So
yeah,
this is the guy you just spent I don't know how long reading, and I commend you for doing that. So tell everybody, before we talk about what he said, what is his accomplishment?
Well, his accomplishment is to write this history book that has broken all records for a book of its type. It's a crossover book, which is what publishers really like to have, because it's a book that can be sold as a textbook and also to a general audience. So his book has sold well over 2.6 million copies since 1980 when it was first published. So it's been in publication for almost 40 years. And it's also unusual in the respect that, unlike other books, where sales taper off after the initial push, his just keep increasing every year, and his influence keeps growing. And, there are also spin-off books, graphic adaptations, curricular materials, you name it, songs are written about him. He is the rock star of historians. But I haven't been able to find anything that he wrote that could be loosely called scholarly.
And the thesis of his people's history is?
Basically that the United States is really a fiction. It has no right to exist. It was founded on the basis of illegitimacy. It was the result of pillage, beginning with the discovery of the New World by Christopher Columbus. And so he has that famous opening where he says that, these Arawak Indians, that's the term he uses for them, came swimming up to the boat that Columbus was on, and they brought them gifts and food. But then, Western civilization that was marked by the religion of, and I'm reading a short passage, by the religion of popes, the government of kings, the frenzy for money led to the torture and murder of them. As a result, the population was just about wiped out. And the same thing with the colonists. It was the European style of war to attack civilians, and the Indians didn't even know of such a concept, which is completely false. So he presents the Americas as this kind of paradise or Garden of Eden, and then the evil Western capitalists come in and ruin it all. And in a people's history, you get the impression that we would be better off without the United States at all. So what he told you was, I think, a little tame compared to what he said.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with that. Did he think any country was better?
He's had a lot of nice things to say for, budding communist regimes. And, he did admit, that Stalin kind of, did some bad things, of course doesn't admit the extent of it. But, there are so many uprisings of people that wanted a communistic government that would finally bring about justice. But the United States, this imperialistic power, always quashed them. Of course, all these so-called people's uprisings were really backed by the Soviet Union, and the people were terrorized. So he lies about that. But he presents this kind of vision that this is what it could be if only the United States would get out of the way and allow, you know, the people to install this kind of, you know, grassroots communistic government. You know, what I was trying to do in this book is, you know, you knew that Howard Zinn was really bad. And, you know, most people who do love this country, you know, pick up his book and think, wow, this is terribly slanted. But as I researched it, I found that he misrepresented authors' words. He left out critical information. He plagiarized. So not only is it a hateful book about the United States, it's also fraudulent history. It's full of lies. I mean, there are lies on every single page. So when you compare what Howard Zinn says to what they say, he is just factually wrong. It's not just he's putting a,
how
you
big
know, a
is,
spin.
How big does the American Indian loom in his work?
Well, he looms very big. In the way that he looms big in William Z. Foster's history of the Americas, William Z. Foster, the communist leader who wrote a book in 1951, and both Howard Zinn and Foster, and as you probably know, Howard Zinn was a member of the Communist Party.
I did not know that. How do you know he was in the Communist Party?
Well, I have looked at his FBI files. It's about over 500 pages. Ron Radosh, who is an expert on such things, he analyzed the file as well and said almost certainly that Howard Zinn was a member of the Communist Party. He denied it, of course, but he taught at a communist school. There were several people who told the FBI agents that he had told them about the Communist Party. They had seen him at meetings. But like most of the communists during that period, he denied it and gave up official membership so he could infiltrate the institutions, and he went into higher education.
For Dennis's complete conversation with Dr. Graybar, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
All the candidates were asked if they support government-provided health care for illegals. All the candidates rushed to raise their hands except Biden.
A new Republican candidate for president with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, Scholastic School Books Cave to Political Correctness.
So the entire book is about a girl thinking that she's bisexual or lesbian in a book aimed at kids who are 8 to 12 years old.
The Poll of Youth yields troubling results.
The coming future of America is going to be less patriotic, it is going to be less religious, and it is also going to be less populated.
We get a close look at the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Their hate map is an outright fraud and a complete scam.
And we hear from the author of Debunking Howard Zinn.
This book is a fraudulent piece of history.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. It's been a while since a sitting president was challenged by a member of his own party. Joe Walsh, former one-term Chicago area congressman and a syndicated talk show host, just announced that he will challenge President Trump in the upcoming primaries. My Salem colleague Mike Gallagher spoke recently about Mr. Walsh's candidacy on the Mike Gallagher Show.
A lot of people wanted to talk about Joe Walsh, the radio host out of Chicago. Well, I think former radio host, I believe, is kind of transitioning out of that process and turning into a guy who wants to primary Donald Trump. And he wants to primary President Trump only because he wants to hurt the Trump presidency. And he figures, well, if I can siphon off enough votes during the early going, maybe Trump will lose to, you know, there's a practical part of this. You know what I mean? Where you've got to think about the country, what the country is like under a president Bernie Sanders or a president Elizabeth Warren. I mean, it kind of brings you to your knees, doesn't it? If it's not Biden, Biden is the most conventional Democrat they have. He's taken a turn left. It's hurting him. I mean, David Marcus over at The Federalist does some analysis. Not only has Biden apologized for half the things he achieved in his decades-long career, he's embraced ideas that 1990s Joe Biden or even 2008's Barack Obama would have derided as absurd. During one of the Democrat police lineups, as David Marcus puts it, all the candidates were asked if they support government-provided cost-free health care for illegals. All the candidates rushed to raise their hands except Biden, who bent his elbow, half raised his hand, and put a finger up to say, yes, but. So, you know, Biden is, if he falls back into the far left worldview, he's done. So you got Joe Walsh, who lost his radio show, and he admits as he's losing his radio show that 90% of his audience disagrees with him. Now, I'm sorry. Let's just look at business sense. If you're a radio host and 90% of your audience who has been with you over the years is saying, stop it, you're wrong, we got to support this guy, the world is against Trump and he's fighting for America, do you hear what your own audience is saying? Oh, I don't care. He's a racist. We get you hate Trump. I get it. I get that people don't like the guy. Please look at the Constitution. Look at judges. Look at taxes. Look at the economy. Look at the policy achievements. Look at the embassy in Israel. Look at all the things that we're so proud of as conservatives and will continue to be achieved over the next 4 years of a Trump reelection.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. And sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Follow us on Twitter at Town Hall Review. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Thanks for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.